CKUT. On the air, live for CKUT. Oh, what? CKUT.
There is this thing. Do you realize do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 24 days into the month of August. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, two episodes of Scott Nye's Talking Radical Radio. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you would like to get involved, you can call 514-448 extension 2593 or email spokenword at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter, at @AvalancheCKUT. Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is now 5:03 p.m. Up now, an episode of Scott Nye's Talking Radical Radio. This episode features the Crip Collective and is titled Anti-Ableism and Disability Justice Education. That's up now.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio.
Disability is not something that only affects specific disabled people. Everybody has varying abilities. They have varying skills. They have varying strengths. And capitalism, society, all of these things really try to enforce an idea of what a normal, typical, productive human being is. And for a lot of us, disabled and non-disabled alike, we don't really fit those categories.
That's the voice of Dev Ramsawak. They and Kate Welsh are today's guests on Talking Radical Radio. This show brings you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people who are involved in many different struggles talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening can strengthen all of our efforts to change the world. Kate Welsh is a white, queer, disabled person who uses she or they pronouns. They're involved in anti-ableism education and visual arts. They work doing research related to ableism, and they have a private practice as a mental health counselor and provide support for queer and trans people who are disabled or chronically ill. Dev Ramsawak is a diasporic Indo-Caribbean gender-fluid disabled artist who uses they and he pronouns. They're a multidisciplinary storyteller who works with a wide range of media, and one key focus for that work is disability justice. Kate and Dev are speaking today about the CRIP Collective, a small group of Toronto-based disabled educators and artists who do anti-ableism, anti-oppression, and disability justice workshops, and various other kinds of community building with disabled people with an intersectional approach. The first word in the collective's name is a slur that some, but certainly not all, disabled people are reclaiming. In the case of this collective, it is also an acronym for Community Resistance Intimacy Project. The story of the collective begins about 5 years ago. Kate was working in the social service sector. She was the only, at least visibly disabled employee at a seemingly progressive nonprofit, the kind of place that had good policies related to anti-racism, anti-oppression, trans inclusion, and so on, and employees with lots of different intersecting identities. But Kate experienced some very blatant ableism in that workplace. Neither their colleagues nor the organization were able to deal with it effectively, and they ended up quitting. The head of the organization asked Kate to connect them with some kind of workshop on anti-oppression and anti-ableism. So she looked around the Toronto context and found, well, nothing. This was a huge gap in the community, and Kate decided to do what they could to fill it. They had co-facilitated some workshops on disability and queerness in earlier years, but they knew that they did not want to take on this new challenge on their own. So they reached out through community networks seeking specifically racialized and queer disabled folks who might want to co-facilitate. And they connected with Dev. The two really hit it off and decided that they wanted to work together. And by 2018, they and another facilitator, Jade Hines, who's no longer with the collective, had developed a workshop they called Unpacking Ableism. Demand for their work was high right from the start. And by 2021, Kate and Dev could no longer meet it on their own, so they invited 5 new members into the collective. They've also been expanding the kinds of things that the collective offers. Along with anti-ableism education ranging from 101 level to more advanced, they also do more focused or specialized workshops, as well as various kinds of disability justice-centered facilitation and community building. In response to a question about the key things that non-disabled people consistently fail to understand about disability, Dev said, quote, "It's pretty much just everything about disability," end quote. Often, non-disabled people treat disability as a discrete thing that can always be clearly and easily identified and then met with clear accommodations. But ableism just isn't reducible to, say, being unable to get into building X or to make use of service Y. Rather, ableism permeates everything about how our world and lives are socially organized. While being disabled can be a vital source of joy, resilience, and community, systemic ableism can, especially for multiply marginalized disabled people, make it nearly impossible to just survive. In the face of all of this, the kind of educational and community building work that the collective does is only one facet of the change work that is needed. But it's an important one. Making a healthcare setting, a workplace, a social service, or a community group into a more livable, less ableist space can make a big difference for the disabled people in that space. And the way Kate and Dev approach it, education is not about making sure people have particular terminology or information, but about cultivating the kind of critical perspective and confidence that can allow people to actively engage in working collectively against ableism. I speak with Kate and Dev about the work of the CRIP Collective.
I'm Dev. I use they, them, or he, him pronouns. I'm what you might call a multidisciplinary storyteller. I am a little bit of a jack of all trades when it comes to media, but all of my work centers disability justice and all of my intersecting identities as a diasporic Indo-Caribbean gender-fluid disabled artist.
My name's Kate. My pronouns are they or she. I am a white, queer disabled person. I use a walker sometimes and also a wheelchair sometimes, depending on the day. I do a lot of different things. I have this collective where we do anti-ableism education. I am an artist. I've done visual art around disability, disability justice, chronic illness, invisible disabilities, lots of things. Currently working at the Center for Independent Living, working on a disability equity project. I'm a researcher at University of Toronto and also at St. Mike's Hospital, where I do research around disability and the healthcare system. And then I also have a private practice where I am a mental health counselor and I provide support for queer and trans, disabled and chronically ill folks, as well as support for couples who are experiencing conflicting access needs. So for me, my life really is around like multi-level, multi-layer look at disability justice. The Crip Collective was started by me and Dev and another person named Jade. It started just as providing workshops around anti-ableism education. And then we've expanded to include more disabled people in our collective. And we do things that are more than just our 101 workshop. Now we do these workshops for lots of different organizations nationally, as well as for disabled groups specifically. So we've run some peer support groups, but mostly we're doing this anti-oppression training focusing on disability inclusion and anti-ableism.
One thing that we are working towards, as well as a collective, is creating community spaces in terms of like getting disabled folks connected to each other, getting disabled folks opportunities to share their experiences or share things that they have to teach and we can learn from, and just getting folks connected to opportunities that will help them thrive rather than just surviving.
How did your collective initially form, and what has its trajectory been through the years?
I have been working in a lot of different jobs, specifically in the social service sector. So in shelters, in mental health support organizations supporting queer and trans people. And I was always the only visibly disabled employee. During some of my schooling, I ran workshops around queerness and disability, looking at the intersections of those two things. But this collective was actually, for me, born out of a negative experience. I was working at a seemingly progressive nonprofit that had progressive policies around anti-racism, anti-oppression, trans inclusion, also had quite substantial intersectionality among the employees, among the management. And I experienced some very blatant ableism at this workplace. And I also experienced that my coworkers and managers and supervisors did not know how to support me when I experienced some pretty blatant ableism. And my coworkers didn't know how to unpack it other than being like, that was wrong. Don't say that. Rather than like being able to talk about the history of ableism in society, in this field, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? There was no unpacking it. It was just like, this is wrong and we don't even know why it's wrong. So I actually ended up resigning from that job after a pretty unsupportive work environment. And the executive director said to me, well, why don't you just bring me a workshop on anti-oppression and anti-ableism? And I looked around and there was nothing. No workshops existed. The workshops that did exist around anti-oppression rarely talked about disability, or it was like something in passing. It wasn't intersectional. It wasn't in depth. So I had previously been doing some work around queerness and disability, some work around community education, but this experience really lit a fire under me to be like, I need to do something because I don't want this experience to happen to other people or to me again. The person that I had previously been facilitating workshops with had moved out of the city, And I think that one person speaking out of the front of the classroom isn't the best learning. And I wanted to build a collective. And I also don't think that it's right for me to be a white person standing at the classroom by myself teaching about this stuff when really we need the voices of other folks.
This was back around, I think, 2017. For me, on my side, I think somebody shared a post with me that Kate had made looking for other disabled folks, specifically racialized and queer disabled folks, who would be interested in getting more experience doing facilitation work and getting involved in doing workshops and things like that. So I responded to Kate's post and we met up at a coffee shop late 2017. It was just like instant friendship. We talked just about how we thought about disability, our experiences, things like that, getting to know each other. Fast forward to about 2018, we decided to create Unpacking Ableism, which is the original workshop that we started. We had another facilitator, Jade Hines, and we decided to just throw Unpacking Ableism together, like develop this workshop on our own and just put it out to the public and be like, okay, we've got this thing. If anybody wants to check it out, we can run it for you. We can also get your feedback, things like that. We put it out thinking it would just be like our communities or folks from our workplaces or just, you know, folks that we knew. But when we actually launched the workshop, we found that there were folks who, you know, found us just by searching up ableism training on Eventbrite. And we're like the only thing that popped up because at least in Toronto, there just wasn't anything else. The first iteration of the workshop was this full day workshop that was back in in-person days. But from there, it grew because it became really clear that there wasn't just a gap in the training, but there was actually like a thirst for that training. Like folks were really interested in it. Jade ended up taking like a step back from the collective to focus on some of their own things. But me and Kate continued on back, I think last year, 2021, we had been getting lots and lots of facilitation requests. Even virtually, it was more than Kate and I could handle on our own. And something we talked about when we began was growing a collective and having more than just us to do these workshops. So we put out a call for some other folks, specifically like racialized folks, prioritizing queer and trans folks, to be able to make sure that we weren't forgetting voices or leaving out perspectives or things like that when we're doing this training. Especially perspectives that are very often erased already. So that's how we brought on Kane, Kitty, Salima, Janelle. And then this year we brought on another member, Midnight. And we have been doing more and more of these workshops. We've been branching out into different kinds of facilitation, different kinds of educating, and different kinds of community building type of things as a collective. And then as individuals, we all have our own arts practices and our own educative practices and careers and things like that. And so we all bring these really diverse perspectives and these different areas of expertise.
I think we're also at the point where maybe we'll keep growing because we have these 101 workshop requests, but we also have community requests and we're starting to be able to be a bit more sustainable because people are paying us money for the workshops. We've started getting some corporate gigs around like media representation of disability and how to support disabled employees and how to build peer programs that are disability inclusive. So there's a lot of momentum around this work. Everyone in our collective is disabled or neurodivergent. Although not everyone identifies with the word CRIP. CRIP is a reclaimed word for people with disabilities. Historically, it was used as a slur, but we've reclaimed it. And then part of disability justice work is really making sure that we're centering the most marginalized voices. So making sure that we're centering the people in our collective who have the various intersections of oppression and making sure that we are continuing to do that as we continue to build our collective, as we continue to facilitate workshops, etc.
Based on your years of experience doing this work, what would you say are the key things that non-disabled people consistently fail to understand about disability and ableism?
Generally, it's pretty much just everything about disability. There's this idea I think a lot of non-disabled folks have that disability is really easy to identify, and that once you have a disability, you're just sort of given accommodations, and that's just that. You know, it's basically living life the same way, but, you know, you use a ramp instead of stairs or whatever. And a lot of folks think that disability is something that you can see, something that you can identify and prove with the naked eye and no medical training. And there's this idea that disability is very defined, that there's a very rigid definition for what disability is and it encompasses. And so with our workshops, the biggest thing that we really focus on is just educating about what disability really is, who's impacted, how people are impacted, what it is like to try and access accommodations, and how multiply marginalized people experience barriers that are unique to their identities. Racialized disabled people experience disability very differently from white disabled people. So there's a lot that people just aren't aware of, and they aren't aware that there are these things to be aware of. I think a lot of folks have this idea that they know about disability and that they are really educated about it because they know phrases like people with disabilities, or, you know, they can tell you where to find the elevator. But it's so much bigger and broader than that. The systems that impact us have these really insidious histories when it comes to disabled people. So I think that the biggest misconception that we are unraveling is that these issues are more than just getting into a building. It's, you know, our basic survival. And for multiply marginalized people, that ability to survive is impacted in so many different ways that it really is set up to be nearly impossible for us to just survive. Like, I'm not even talking about just having comfortable lives. Just being able to survive is something that is made difficult for us.
People aren't aware of the fact that the biggest minority is disabled people. 1 in 5 people in Canada is disabled, and probably more than that, especially because we're going through COVID right now, which is a mass disabling event worldwide. I think people have this idea that they're not going to become disabled, but that's a total myth, right? Like, we all have bodies, so we all are inevitably going to become disabled. We all have internalized ableism that is impacted by productivity and capitalism. And so thinking about how do we change systems, change attitudes, change how people treat each other so that hopefully when they become disabled, they're not having to go through what it was like when I became disabled like 20 years ago, or when Dev was born or whatever. I also want to say one thing that we really try to do in our workshops is make it okay for people to ask questions that they might feel uncomfortable asking. So it's really getting people to talk about, like, what are the practical ways that we can support them to make them feel comfortable talking about disability, and in turn, make it better for disabled people to, like, live in the world.
Disability is not something that only affects specific disabled people. Everybody has varying abilities. They have varying skills. They have varying strengths. And capitalism, society, all of these things really try to enforce an idea of what a normal, typical, productive human being is. And for a lot of us, disabled and non-disabled alike, we don't really fit those categories. And the expectations that are put on us by capitalism, even for non-disabled folks, the levels of productivity that we are expected to be sustaining long-term, it's only been in the last like 50, 60 years that we have been at this level of productivity while the wealth disparity gap is still growing and folks are getting sick, they're getting hurt by capitalism, they're getting disabled by poverty, by overworking themselves, by trying to push through. It's really this very individualist attitude that capitalism promotes, that we earn for ourselves, we have to earn our way through life, we have to prove that we are a productive member of society and that we earn all the resources that we get, instead of thinking about resources as, okay, let's make sure everybody has the resources we need, let's make sure we all take care of each other. What capitalism does is it promotes a very specific type of care. It's about buying things, whereas what disability justice is focused on and what disabled people really need and what society needs as a whole is community care and interdependence. And that's the ability to like rely on each other and not have to fend for ourselves all the time and things like that.
In the context of the many different kinds of change work that ableism demands, as multifaceted, pervasive, systemic, and often incredibly harsh as it is, what do you see as the specific importance and role of the educational mode that is the focus of your group's work?
For me, education feels like one of the best ways to enact social change because you're working on changing attitudes and behaviors at a very base level. And we know that there's other people doing other sorts of change, like policy change and building change or whatever. But the education piece for me, I saw was really lacking. And also that's personally where I think I have a strength. I feel like I have strength in doing educational work. And education is so, so, so broad that there's so many things that education can touch. Where do we learn to be ableist? Where is that taught to us? And so we do talk about like the media and other things within our education. I think also our education, you know, we have a chance to do on the ground stuff with youth. We have a chance to do education with healthcare providers who are on the ground shaping disabled people's view of themselves. We have a chance to educate like CBC employers who are doing work around media representation. So for me, education feels like a very broad way to do systems change work. And we also know that disabled people are excluded from all parts of society, but education is really like embedded in all parts of society. So it feels to me like a balance, you know, bringing disabled people into this work is like bringing us into places where we're historically excluded and actually being the like experts at the front of the classroom or on the screen or whatever. And education also feels good to me because for me, it's important to do collective work and education feels like inherently collective to me.
We are trying to push back against this idea that you need formal training, you know, a degree in something in order to be an expert. This is something that is especially important to push back against because of the harm that medical communities have inflicted upon disabled folks of all kinds throughout history and currently. There's medical bias of all kinds. There's reported studies on racism in healthcare. And I think that is also really important to acknowledge that our educational systems currently work as capitalist propaganda. The way that our curriculums are built, the way that we are expected to learn in very specific ways, it's all built to make us into perfect workers, make us into the productive drone who will do the work and not question authority and be like, okay, history class taught me that the government officials are always able to figure it out in the end. And, you know, that's just something I will live with. And that's, you know, something that we are seeing in action today with COVID. You know, there's a lot of folks who aren't paying attention to what the actual news, what the actual science, what the actual studies are saying about COVID. They're relying on government officials to be looking out for their best interests. And clearly that's not happening. So when we are thinking about education, we want to change folks' ideas of who we value as educators, who we take seriously, whose perspectives are we paying attention to and valuing, and is it worth it? A major part of our education work is conversations. We don't just come into our workshops and throw information at you and go, okay, this is what you need to know. You know, there's no test, there's no whatever. What it is we come in, we give folks the language to be able to engage in conversation with us. And then we work with folks and meet them where they're at in terms of what their experiences are, what their perspectives are. And it is not about getting the language right. It's about having the understanding to be able to walk away from those workshops and be able to think critically about what is happening around you and be able to identify issues without anybody having to explain to you why it's an issue.
You have been listening to my interview with Dev Ramsawak.
MTL versus racism.
Montreal versus racism.
MTL versus racism.
A concert united against racism and discrimination.
Un concert uni contre racisme et la discrimination.
Saturday, the 10th of September, 6 to 10 p.m. in Girouard Park.
Samedi, le 10 septembre, 18h à 22h, à Parc Girouard, Indigé.
Avec des performances de
Jonathan Emile,
Shawit,
Maritza,
Remy Picasso,
Paul Carniello,
DJ Lady Oracle.
Collecte de fonds pour Résilience Montréal.
Raising money for Resilience Montreal.
Tout le monde et tous les âges sont bienvenus.
Everybody is welcome.
This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is now 5:31. Up now is another episode of Scott Nye's Talking Radical Radio, titled Grassroots Organizing by Métis People in Winnipeg. That's up now.
And all of the actions that we are taking as a collective are always rooted in our relations to the land, our relations to community, our relations to ourselves, our relations to one another. And that's not just as Métis people, but that's also relations to our First Nation kin, our Black relatives, our folks of color that are also our relatives.
That's the voice of Chantel Garand. They, Brianne Lavallee-Heckert, and Kiana Durston are today's guests on Talking Radical Radio. This show brings you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people who are involved in many different struggles, talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening can strengthen all of our efforts to change the world. All three of today's guests live in Winnipeg, in Treaty 1 territory. Lavallee-Heckert is a Métis woman who studied law and now does community work in Winnipeg. Garand is a non-binary and two-spirit Métis person who did a degree in criminal justice and sociology and who is active in abolitionist organizing in the city. And Durston is a Métis woman who did a degree in environmental science and works as an aquatic science technician. All three are members of Red River Echoes, a grassroots collective of Métis people who are focused on land back and on the active reclamation of Métis sovereignty in Winnipeg. The group got its start in the spring of 2021. The catalyst was David Chartrand, president of the Manitoba Métis Federation, which is the Métis government in Manitoba, placing a full-page ad in the Winnipeg Free Press in support of the Winnipeg Police Service. This was around the one-year anniversary of the Winnipeg police shooting and killing 16-year-old Anishinaabe girl Aisha Hudson. Lavallee-Heckert said many Métis people felt, quote, pure shock and anger, end quote, at the ad. The group came together to issue an open letter giving voice to this anger and to broader objections to the very presence of colonial police on Métis lands. This happened in the context of longer-standing dissatisfactions with the MMF and its current leadership. The MMF is, according to Garand, quote, replicating colonial governments, end quote, thereby manifesting an approach to governance very different than traditional Métis ways of doing things, and also doing harm to their First Nations relatives and to their relations with them. The level of support the letter received made it an easy choice to make Red River Echoes into an ongoing group. The collective's actions have included, for instance, participating as a contingent in the July 1st walk in Winnipeg in the wake of the discovery of unmarked graves at residential school sites. When a First Nations man was violently arrested during the walk, members of Red River Echoes and other people successfully took action to de-arrest him. They subsequently arrived at the Manitoba legislature just as people were toppling statues of Queen Victoria and Queen Elizabeth II. The collective knew immediately that they wanted to support their relatives who had taken that action, and so they started a fund to put towards bail and legal expenses. Next, they set their sights on the Winnipeg neighborhood of Wolseley. It's named after colonial military official Sir Garnet Wolseley, who led British troops that came to the Red River Territory in 1870 to put down the Métis Rebellion. Initially, they blanketed the neighborhood with posters calling for it to be renamed. Then they organized a gathering that brought Métis people together in traditional ways to discuss the issue. An ongoing goal is to obtain what they describe as a land-back bus for Métis and First Nations people in Winnipeg to use in reconnecting with their territories beyond the city. Their fundraising for the bus will include sale of a t-shirt celebrating all of the colonial statues toppled across Turtle Island in the last couple of years. Even without having a bus yet, this past summer they organized a trip by Métis people to Batoche, the site of the final military defeat of Métis and allied peoples by colonial forces in 1885. The collective has plans to make another trip to Batoche next summer. Other future plans include setting up a Patreon to make it easier for people to financially support the collective's work, and in the new year, they'll be hosting a teach-in on police and prison abolition, specifically focused on its relevance to Métis people in the Red River Territory. The collective sees their actions as part of enacting a vision of governance and sovereignty that they say is much more in line with traditional Métis practices. In the spirit of the characterization of the Métis as, quote, the people who own themselves, end quote, it's a sort of decentralized, embodied sovereignty that resolutely rejects colonial ways of doing things and that is grounded in being in good relation with each other, with the land, with their First Nations kin, and with Black and racialized relatives. I speak with Lavallee Heckert, Garand, and Durston about Red River Echoes.
My name is Brianne Lavallee Heckert. I am a Métis woman from Red River, Treaty 1. My family is from St. Ambrose, Manitoba, a small Métis community on the southern tip of Lake Manitoba. And I also have, on my father's side, German settlers. I completed a Bachelor of Arts at the University of Winnipeg in Human Rights, and then I went on to do a Juris Doctor and Bachelor of Civil Law at McGill. I graduated last year and moved back from Montreal to Red River, and now I'm just doing community work here, trying to think creatively about how to use law in different ways.
I'm Chantal Garand, Métis human from Red River, non-binary, two-spirited. My family has been historically scattered throughout the Red River Valley, but I've always been from Treaty 1 in Winnipeg specifically. I went to school for criminal justice and sociology at University of Winnipeg and have taken an interesting route, but mostly involved in community organizing in Winnipeg, specifically around abolition and our city budget and how that relates to community care, as well as, and most importantly, Red River Echoes, because it's been the most fulfilling organizing and collective that I've been a part of.
And I am Kiana Durston. I am also a Métis woman from Red River. My family came from St. Anne's, although I grew up in Treaty 1 in Winnipeg, along with Chantal and Brianne. I went to school for environmental science at the University of Manitoba, and I work now as an aquatic science technician on Lake Winnipeg. I have been a member with Red River Echoes, and connecting and reconnecting to the land has been really fulfilling for me within this group.
Red River Echoes is a collective of Métis people from Red River, but I think we have other members from Northern Manitoba as well, or whose families come from there. We formed in March of this year. We are a Métis collective, and we're focused on land back and active reclamation of Métis sovereignty in Winnipeg. And that includes like restoring kinship relations, restoring practices like visiting. And then that also includes advocating the recognition that our liberation as Métis people is tied up with the liberation of our First Nations relatives and our Black relatives. We formed directly in response to President David Chartrand of the Manitoba Métis Federation taking out a full-page ad in the Winnipeg Free Press in support of the Winnipeg Police Service. This was close to the year anniversary of Aisha Hudson, a 16-year-old Anishinaabe girl who was murdered by Winnipeg police. It was close to the one-year anniversary of that. I think it was just sort of the last straw for many of us young Métis people, and some not so young. But I think what really grounded us and brought us together was just like the pure shock and anger over our Métis government supporting the Winnipeg police in that way and in such a violent way to Aisha Hudson and her family. We got into a lot of trouble with the Manitoba Métis Federation for that. We launched an open letter saying that we disagree with David Chartrand supporting the Winnipeg police, that as Métis people, we don't believe in colonial police on our lands. And the next day he told us that anybody who questions his government can go to hell. So we came into the scene with a bang, I guess, in that way. Since then, we've just been working together to give a different perspective of what Métis governance can look like. So yeah, we formed in response to the police ad, but I think it was also a longer standing sentiment of not feeling like the Manitoba Métis Federation was representative of who we were as Métis people in Red River.
I would say that it was very affirming to meet so many Métis folks that have felt the same way about how we were governed and like the ways in which we would like to see that change.
What are some of those broader concerns about the MMF?
I think a very common concern is that the MMF is turning into something that is replicating colonial governments. And when that is happening, that's placing Métis people who don't have their voice aside from who says they are their voice, i.e. the MMF, placing them in a very tough spot because we don't feel that way. And if our government, and I'm using air quotes here, is replicating colonial government structures, colonial government standpoints, colonial government talking points, then we're doing harm to the people that we stand in solidarity with always and always have been. And if we look at the history of Métis people in Manitoba, in Red River, that's not how Métis people were brought about. That's not how Métis people govern themselves. And going back to that ad being the catalyst, many Métis people don't feel the way that David Chartrand wants us to feel.
One of the big concerns, too, is repairing the relationship that we have with our First Nations relatives. Historically, as Métis people, we've lived on these lands in good relationship with our Cree relatives, with our Anishinaabe relatives, and restoring those practices and honoring that and recognizing that those legal systems, those kinship systems, they're all still there, and that we, as Métis people, have a responsibility to live up to those. As Métis people, the lands that we live on, the only reason why we were able to live here was because we were in good relation with our relatives. And so we need to go back to that, or else we're just replicating harm. Another thing, too, in regards to the MMF and some of the issues, it's structurally set up as a corporation, and that's not democracy. You know, it's not democracy if it's just cabinet ministers making decisions that nobody really knows about and that they're dressed in really fancy legal language at general assemblies. And it's a very isolating process. You know, it takes Métis people out of our government system, out of the way that we own ourselves and the way that we decide for ourselves.
So the MMF published the ad. Then you issued the open letter. How did you end up deciding to become something ongoing?
I think an important thing to note here, too, is how many people reached out anonymously or with their own names, but were very afraid of speaking out against this Métis Federation government. If people are afraid to speak out against their so-called leaders, what's that telling you about how people are so-called leading? I think that that was also a driving point in knowing that we were doing the right thing because of how much, and I'm using air quotes again, but like trouble this was causing.
And I think that that was exactly why we decided to even continue as a group, just like seeing how many people were so excited to finally see that there was a group, like a collective of people who were willing to speak up and to say that what David Chartrand is doing is not representative of all Métis people. I think it was just really overwhelming for the first little while. The other thing that made us decide to keep working as a collective was that we all just really loved being around each other and that there was so much healing going on for us, just even as individuals coming together and, you know, healing our own relationships with ourselves and with community and really coming back into that as Métis people. And I think that was really exciting for us. So then after that, we just started doing stuff.
We've done a number of things, and all of the actions that we are taking as a collective are always rooted in our relations. Our relations to the land, our relations to community, our relations to ourselves, our relations to one another. And that's not just as Métis people, but that's also relations to, you know, our First Nation kin, our Black relatives, our folks of color that are also our relatives. So we've taken a number of actions in a very short time that have been very intense, very aggressive in terms of like our immediate response to certain things. So, for example, July 1st, a number of us in Treaty 1 in Winnipeg, we attended the walk for, you know, shortly after 2:15.
And that's a reference to the discovery of unmarked graves at residential school sites.
We attended that walk together as a collective. Within two blocks, there was a violent arrest happening of a First Nations man. And myself and other collective members were immediately involved in the de-arrest of that person. And it was pretty intense. And then the march continued on. There was a few dozen of us that were a part of this de-arrest. And by the time we got to the Manitoba legislature, the statue was starting to come down. And it was just like this really euphoric space to be a part of that. But the first thought after that statue came down and after we all left was, okay, how do we assist? Because we know our relatives who were associated with that. How do we help them now? So we started a bail fund. We put a call out and we brought in legal funds for folks who are going to need it. Nothing has happened yet. About 2 months ago, the police said that they passed on everything to the prosecutor. So we're just awaiting that. Obviously, we don't believe that any colonial statue or any colonial figure should be honored. And to be able to come together so quickly, to be able to support folks who are taking direct action like that is so incredibly important. And then I think we immediately moved on to our renaming of Wolseley, where in one night we put up about 200 posters in a Wolseley neighborhood, specifically calling for the renaming of this violent colonial figure who came to our lands with the intent to eradicate us. And the response to that was also great. A lot of support. And then you get, you know, the few naysayers. We followed up with a renaming rendezvous in traditional Métis ways. You know, we had our food and we had a circle to talk about things and we had a silent auction for folks. And then we've kind of moved on to a number of different projects that are all on the go right now.
It seems, too, that all of our decisions happened so fast, and they did. Everything came together so quickly, but it was able to go the pace that it did because we were also intentional with the decisions and the way in which we wanted to take those actions. And they were all intentional to like the relations that we have for each other and for the land and for our relatives. When each project and each action came up, we were like, okay, yeah, this is clearly the right decision for our whole collective and where we want to go from here.
It's so refreshing to be a part of, and especially like myself being a part of multiple organizing entities that are draining because they're very white-centered spaces. And very often I'm the Indigenous person in those spaces, and it's very draining. But I think with everything our collective has done, it doesn't feel that way because not only are we organizing, but we're healing ourselves in that same process. And when we don't have that capacity, we also have healing circles to support one another.
I totally agree. It's the most energizing collective I've ever been a part of.
For a group that uses consensus-based decision-making and rotational leadership, we're really, really effective despite that. I think some people might be scared to use looser models of organizing, but for us, we've really found that like we have a constitution, we have a structure set out and everything, but we also recognize that we are human and that we need to be flexible with each other and with ourselves. And it's worked really, really well so far. I feel like it's so easy for us to agree on what those intentions are because we're rooting this all in who we are as Métis people and our laws and these very like ancestral, historic things that live inside of us. And tapping into that power that we have as Indigenous peoples, as sovereign peoples on our own lands. being able to root all of our decisions in that has made it really easy. You know, like, we just do the thing that's right. And I actually have a Gabrielle Dumont quote that I just wanted to share. It says, "No people in the world are as strong and good as the Métis. Given a choice between riches and their rights, they would choose rights and everything would be right in the end." Like, we're here to fight for our rights, to fight for our people, to fight for our lands. And so when we're focused on that, it's really easy to be like, okay, let's do this big thing, because that's what our ancestors did. You know, our ancestors were the last people to lead an armed resistance against the Canadian state. What a powerful legacy for us to live up to.
What can you say in general terms about the membership of the collective?
Most of our members are based in Winnipeg. We do have members all across the homeland, though. I think we have 30 members. We have like a process for welcoming in folks.
We might only have 30 members right now, but like the amount of people who have reached out that we've had to develop a process for to intake and like have not been able to keep up because, you know, with the organizing, like the interest and the amount of people who are wanting to join is high.
Our membership is quite young, probably like between 20 and 45. But at the same time, we're not just working with ourselves. Like, we also reach out to community. So we have elders that we are in contact with and that are at our healing circles, different things like that. So even though our membership is more on the younger side, we're still focused on the intergenerational aspect of our work. We recognize that unless we're consulting elders, we're not going to be doing this in a good way. We have been really intentional about making sure that while we have members, Red River Echoes doesn't just belong to us. It's a larger thing, I guess, for Métis people. Even if somebody's not necessarily a member, we still see them as part of our Red River Echoes family.
When it comes to our constitution, we have, like Brianne had said, 30 members. However, those are people that maybe have the capacity to be active in the circles and decisions and actions that we take. But we have a larger group of community members who may not be involved with weekly meetings and decision makings that we're doing, but they are still involved with the events that we put on.
You've mentioned the importance for the collective of grounding your work in relations, including with your First Nations kin and with Black and racialized relatives. How does consciousness of those relations play into the group's activities?
So I think that is shown through our continuous actions. All of our decisions are guided by community, and we're not doing anything that is specifically for us. So an upcoming thing that we've been planning for a little bit is a land back bus. We're planning to fund this bus. A lot of it goes back to another initiative that got us a grant to go back to Batoche. It was basically a land back trip for Métis people. Initially, the thought was that we could maybe get a land back bus to drive to Batoche and, you know, go on this land back trip and go back to Métis roots and go to the history, go to the site, go and be with ancestors, be with that knowledge, be with community in Batoche. And it didn't work out that we got the bus for Batoche, but, you know, maybe we rented some SUVs and had some land back SUVs. But that trip brought a lot for us individually, collectively, as a whole. And after that trip, it was like, yeah, this needs to happen, not only for us, but for a lot of people. A big barrier to land back is not only that the land was taken from us, is that we actually physically cannot get there. And so with the land back bus, not only can we use it to go back to land as a Métis collective, but also share it with our relatives so that they too can go back to the land, that they can use it in ways that they feel is in a healing way or a way that they, you know, feel that they need to use it. And it's things like that that really guide where this collective is going, because we could easily, you know, get a bus and just be like, oh, it's the Red River Echoes bus. But like, our immediate thought was, this needs to be for all of us. And we need to do it in a way where all of us can use this vehicle in a collective way, in relation with one another, in a community way. And we need to be able to use this to heal ourselves, to empower our communities, and to further land back within our relations.
you know, as Métis people, we've historically lived between two worlds, so to speak. We have a very interesting history as a people, as, you know, a very new nation and an Indigenous nation that occurred post-contact. So that's what guides us, is, you know, knowing that we have this unique position as Métis people of, you know, being traditionally these go-betweens or people who are able to communicate across different languages, you know, different cultures, and being a bridge in that way.
Historically, colonial institutions have tried to like beat us down to the point where we just kind of align within white Canada, I guess I could call it that, and go within the structures that they would like us to go. That has created a lot of disruption within our relations. And I think it is radical of us to be able to say, no, we're not going to be following this path of destruction of our relations with one another. And we're going to take the time to heal that and support one another and be there for each other and make those decisions that are going to help our First Nation relatives and not just help ourselves.
How do you understand the kinds of actions that your group has taken as building towards that different vision of governance that you mentioned in the context of the Métis Nation?
The Métis people have historically been called the people who own themselves. So the idea that we have a fixed centralized government, an institution like the MMF, isn't historically accurate. Even our provisional government that Louis Riel created, that was a provisional government. It was not supposed to be permanent. Our leadership, the way that Métis people have historically governed themselves, has been for temporary times and for a purpose. And otherwise, we are people who own ourselves and we are in good relation with others, following law, but recognizing that we are fiercely independent, fiercely stubborn peoples, and actually taking that seriously and owning that. And so I think every time we take an action, it's how can we own ourselves? How can we show Métis sovereignty? How can we live Métis sovereignty? Just for example, like the renaming rendezvous that we had in the Wolseley area, regardless of what the outcomes may be in terms of the name, the fact that there was a group of Métis people on Métis land in the middle of Winnipeg talking about the genocide that occurred and still being here and being proud to be Métis still and just actually taking up that physical space, I think has been part of it as well for us. You know, just the physicality of that. It's kind of hard to think about sovereignty in like a practical way, but I think what we're experiencing is that when we gather and when we are together, that's exercising sovereignty.
What else do you want listeners to know about what Red River Echoes has planned for the next while?
So there's the Land Back bus that we'll be doing a call out for. But then in the new year, we are going to be doing a teach-in on abolition. We're looking to develop a workbook and plan the whole like facilitation process and the content and talk about the history of policing, how it relates to Métis people on this land specifically. And we're also going to talk about future building, and we're going to start talking about what it's going to look like when the Winnipeg Police no longer exist here. Next summer, we're also planning to go back to Batoche again, but who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what decisions we'll make and what actions will need to be taken before then?
I think another fun thing that's coming up is
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize consciousness is affected? There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize our consciousness is affected? There is this thing going on. What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
That completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, you can follow us on Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact the Avalanche at avalancheckut.ca or CKUT's spoken word department at 514-448-4041, extension 2593, or email spokenword@ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Hersey, that's up next.
It's the boy Dash all the way from Grenada and tune in to C-Cut 90.3 FM.
Avec un crisse de gros E à cause que c'est toujours bien la base d'essayer d'inclure tout le monde. Dans le fond, là, tout ou pantoute, c'est comme le coup de buffer qu'il faut passer au printemps sur la porte du camp parce qu'elle ferme plus, esti. Bon, fait qu'aujourd'hui, on profite du contexte du début du beau temps et de la tenue de l'événement Mes poils pour parler pilosité et normes de beauté.
J'ai parlé avec Camille Paré-Poirier, qui est ambassadrice pour l'événement Mes poils, événement qui nous invite pendant tout le mois de mai à donner une plus grande place aux poils, à les laisser pousser, puis à en parler.
Puis moi, j'ai rencontré Safia Nolin, dont le Québec au complet surveille constamment le linge et l'apparence, au lieu de porter attention à sa musique, qui a pourtant une immense valeur artistique.
Ici Alexandra Turgeon.
Et Laurie Perron.
Vous écoutez Tout ou Pantoute. Hey, on est assez énervé de parler de poils aujourd'hui. Est-ce qu'on présente tout de suite notre première invitée, Laurie?
Oui, oui, oui. Puis moi, je vais t'écouter la présenter en me flattant le poil de dessous de bras pour l'occasion.
J'ai rencontré Camille Paré-Poirier, qui est ambassadrice pour Mes poils depuis 2018. Si vous ne connaissez pas Mes poils, c'est un événement qui existe depuis 2017, puis qui se tient, comme son nom l'indique, pendant tout le mois de mai, qui nous invite à essayer de redonner ou de donner une place plus importante